Last week, we covered the colonial period, when America was composed of 13 British colonies from 1607, Jamestown, to 1776, the Declaration of Independence. And during that period, there was a Great Awakening. In the middle decades of the 18th century, 1730 to 1750, roughly. And there were two major figures that were leaders in that revival: George Whitefield, who preached up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and Jonathan Edwards, who sort of channeled the revival in a solid theological direction. So those two men were sort of partners in being at the forefront of that Great Awakening. But as we move into the 1760s and 70s, the country is beginning to yearn for independence and having great tension with Britain over the Stamp Act and the Coercive Acts and over many other things. And so you would then enter into a 6.5 year brutal revolutionary war from Lexington Green, where the first shots are fired in April of 74, until the surrender at Yorktown in October of 1781. So 6.5 years of a brutal civil war that sort of saps the energy of the nation. And again, it creates a spiritual vacuum. And these kinds of wars are always the worst, these civil wars, as it were. It was Americans against British, but it was also loyalists against patriots. So by the end of the 1700s, the spiritual atmosphere of now the United States of America is at a low ebb. And at all these times like this, whether in England or in America, really wherever God's people are, God is concerned about his church and he's committed to his people. And he will move in with discipline, as well as with, if they're listening, revival and renewal. So in the early 1800s, really I've given the dates here of the Second Great Awakening, 1790 to 1850. It really starts after the Revolutionary War and the Constitutional Convention, and Washington is now president, and we have an emerging nation. And in that last decade, and in the early decades of the 19th century, there is what has been called the Second Great Awakening. And in this Second Great Awakening, there is not one central leader or figure. It's really led by local pastors and evangelists, and even a lot of lay leaders in these churches that have been planted up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And especially as Americans are now streaming across the Appalachian Mountains and going west, and even beginning to cross the Mississippi with the Louisiana Purchase, now you have a continent, not just an eastern seaboard. And these preachers are going out to these frontier areas, and they're having what are called camp meetings, frontier camp meetings. And it especially involves Methodists, Baptists, and Presbyterians in the hinterland of the emerging nation. The beginning of Second Great Awakening is oftentimes attributed to a meeting in Cane Ridge, Kentucky, when many people were converted. But there are many other camp meetings like this that take place in sort of the emerging areas of the frontier areas of America as people move west. Especially, you have Methodist circuit riders. You remember Francis Asbury and Thomas Coke came over from England to become the first bishops of the Methodist Church. And they sent out these circuit riders on horseback to go village to village and town to town, and they preached the gospel. They lived very simple apostolic lives of sacrifice, and they preached the gospel. There were also a lot of Baptists who went out. A lot of them were sort of bivocational farmer preachers who fanned out throughout the South and the opening up of the West. And these evangelical Methodists and Baptists became the dominant religious force in America during the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and so forth up to the Civil War. So if you go, you can just get in your car and you can travel through West Virginia or South Carolina or Virginia or Georgia or wherever and go to these small towns, and you'll find Baptist and Methodist churches and occasionally a Presbyterian church as well. But these oftentimes were are churches that sort of attribute their beginning to the Second Great Awakening. So the Second Great Awakening had a much more powerful, lasting influence on the emerging nation, the United States of America, than the First Great Awakening did. It had a tremendous impact that even continues to this day. So just like when the fervor of the churches began to wane in the 18th century, God raised up George Whitefield. Now in the early decades of the 19th century, after the Revolutionary War, as the nation's energy was sapped with this brutal war and spiritual fervor began to wane, God again sent out people to preach and teach and disciple and to plant churches. And up until the Civil War, this became a country that was just populated with church-going, Bible-reading people. Large percentage of the population, probably over two-thirds, were church-going and Bible-reading people. Now, as we get to the latter years of the 19th century, there was also a very famous evangelist named Charles Grandison Finney, who had these outdoor mass crusades, tent meetings and revival meetings, and he preached the gospel. I don't know how many of you have studied the life of Charles Finney. He's a very interesting individual. He founded Oberlin College. He was a leader in the abolitionist movement to stop slavery. But he was the first large-scale pioneer mass evangelist with these crusades. And but he primarily was having these up in the cities in the Northeast, not so much out in the West. He was then emulated by Dwight Moody. You've heard that name, Moody Bible Institute. In the 20th century, Billy Sunday, and ultimately, we know most of all, Billy Graham. So going back to Finney, Moody, Sunday, Graham, and many other lesser figures, America has sort of a tradition of these crusades. Evangelistic crusades where churches are brought together and invite people. And of course, Billy Graham is the one who's most known and probably has had the greatest widespread impact because media was really coming in at that point and he was on television and all that in the 1950s, 60s, 70s on up. So Charles Grandison Finney, there are those who believe that Finney's sort of techniques were somewhat manipulative. He's got mixed reviews. If you read his life, you'll see people, some like what he did. Others think that it really didn't have much of a lasting impact. But certainly Moody, Sunday, and Graham did have a tremendous impact in certain parts of the country. The other person I want to mention during this period in the early 1800s is a man named Richard Allen. His is a life that's really worth studying. He was a slave in Delaware. And in about 1810, 1809, 1810, right there, he was one of the slaves where his master allowed him to learn to read and write. There were many slaves that did not want many slave owners that did not want their slaves to read and write because they might rebel. But there were some that were more benign and more kind masters, although slavery is a terrible institution. they did allow them to learn to read and write. And he learned really to read and write, especially the Bible. And he was radically converted to faith in Christ. And he led his master to Christ. And his master then freed him as a result of that. He realized, I cannot hold slaves anymore as a Christian, for one of the rare examples of that. And he freed Richard Allen, and he became the founder of what was called the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Church. The AME Church, African, is largely but not exclusively an African American denomination. It's Methodist in theology, and it's Episcopalian in church government. So it's the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church. It's the largest black denomination in the South. Very large denomination. You may not know that, but there are AME churches all over the South. I had many, I mean, many AME students in my classes over the years at Columbia Biblical Seminary where I taught. And they loved the Word of God, and they loved their communities. And a lot of the pastors are some of my former students of these churches, especially in South and North Carolina. So the AME denomination. June 17th, 2015. You know what happened June 17th, 2015? You'll remember if I, when I tell you, a young man walked into a Bible study that was taking place on Wednesday night at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, an old historical church. There was about 12, 15, African American believers there having Bible study being led by their pastor. He walked in, had his backpack, sat down with them. They thought he was joining them, so they gave him a Bible and welcomed him. About halfway through the Bible study, he pulled out his gun and shot nine of them dead, including the pastor. Shot the pastor in the head. That was a moment when we were living in South Carolina. South Carolina has a long history of racial tension. Long history. Charleston especially. And we wondered, is there going to be race riots? What's going to happen? The pastors of the African American churches in Charleston came together and they said, we're not going to riot, we're going to pray. We're going to pray that this will become a moment of reconciliation after all these years of tension. So they came together and prayed, and the governor of South Carolina went down there, and instead of stirring up tension, her name is Nikki Haley. Heard of her? Nikki Haley came down to Charleston. She brought the community together rather than dividing the community. She brought the community together. It was her finest moment as a governor. And it was. I didn't go down, but there were prayer meetings. There was a large gathering in downtown Charleston, and Nikki Haley said, "We are going to remove the Confederate flag from the state grounds of South Carolina. It's been up there long enough. We're going to put it where it should be, in a Confederate memorial, in a Confederate museum." And it was a wonderful, wonderful, courageous, courageous move by Nikki Haley. Governor David Beasley, 2 years before, had said the same thing. He, by the way, Governor David Beasley is a born-again evangelical Christian, governor of South Carolina. He was on the board of trustees of the seminary where I taught. Wonderful man. And he said the same thing, and he got drummed out of office. But through this terrible, tragic event, the murder of these black believers in their church having a Bible study, there was a reconciliation and a renewal of the relationship between the black and white churches in Charleston. It was a wonderful, wonderful good that came out of a terrible tragedy. Well, I thank God for Nikki Haley, and I thank God for the pastors, and especially for the family members of those whose loved ones got shot to death that night. Instead of calling for vengeance and anger, they said, we're going to pray for the soul of that young man who came in here and killed our loved ones and our pastor. So the power of Christian charity and forgiveness, great redemptive moment, the AME Church. Now, as we move to the middle decades of the 19th century, 1850s to 1900, 1850s to 1900, we went through a brutal civil war, terrible carnage. 700,000 boys, North and South, were killed in that war. And again, just like the Revolutionary War, it sort of sapped the energy, the spiritual energy of the churches. And by the way, I want to start today by asking you a trivia question. Ask you a trivia question. This country, United States of America, has had 45 men occupy the office of president. 45. Now, Trump is number 47, but Grover Cleveland and Trump had split terms. So 47th, but there's only 45 individuals. Here's a question for you. Don't answer it right now. Just think about it. How many of those 45 men have been baptized members of a Christian denomination? Don't answer right now. Just think about that. Now, when I say baptized, I mean either as children into their as babies or later as adults. They've been baptized members of a Christian denomination. So we'll come back to that in just a minute. Come back to that in just a minute. Now, the late 19th century, there arose in the Western world, not just America, but in the Western world, it came over here in waves as well, a number of ideological challenges that challenged traditional Christian faith. Head-on challenges by a number of philosophical, ideological currents. And I have summarized four of those, which I think are four of the most important. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the Western world began to turn in a decidedly secular direction. And if not atheistic, agnostic direction during the latter decades of the 19th century. There were other reasons as well, the Industrial Revolution, the dehumanizing of people through various political and sociological policies and so forth. But especially because of these powerful ideological currents or worldviews that were spawned in Europe, and whatever starts in Europe ends up coming here, right? Because we have Europe is our background, European background for the most part. So, and I want to just summarize four of these. One is rationalism, and the leading figure there was a man named Immanuel Kant. He wrote this book, Critique of Pure Reason, in 1781, but he spawned a whole philosophical worldview. He was the kind of the leader, but others followed along and refined his ideas. And his basic postulate is this: human reason, not divine revelation, is the only way to know truth. Human reason will lead us to discover truth, not some sort of divine revelation from a supernatural God who breaks into history. So Immanuel Kant, and he was a very, very influential individual. And he lived to a ripe old age, taught for about 50 years at the University of Königsberg in Northeast Germany. So rationalism. Human reason is to be valued above everything else, not some sort of divine revelation from God. Number two, Charles Darwin. You all know Darwin, biological evolution. He wrote On the Origin of Species in 1859, and his basic postulate is that human beings evolve from primitive life forms through natural selection. That is the principle, natural selection. Design and purpose in an intelligent creator who designs the world and creates man in his own image with a moral nature is a myth. Rather, life is random and it's a struggle and ultimately a impersonal principle of natural selection determines everything, essentially survival of the fittest. He later wrote a book, The Descent of Man, in which he took it further, and now he argues that human beings are descended from primates, from primitive life forms, monkeys, and then man. So that's Charles Darwin. Very, very influential. I grew up in the public school system. I was marinated in Darwinian evolution growing up. Did not grow up in a Christian family. We'll come back to him in just a moment. Thirdly, Karl Marx. Everybody know Karl Marx, right? dialectical materialism. Very influential. He wrote his book, The Communist Manifesto, and later Das Kapital, Capitalism, 1848 and into the 1860s and 70s. You have his life's dates there, 1818 to 1883. His basic argument is economic and class forces direct human history. It's a constant struggle between the economic marginalized working class, the proletariat, and the elite, entitled class, the bourgeois, and they're battling away in an eternal class struggle, and ultimately the proletariat will prevail, and there will be a one-class system. The dictatorship of the proletariat. That's where we're heading toward, the utopia. So, Marxist theology, you could call it, or Marxist philosophy, is the third great current that began to challenge traditional Christian faith. Rationalism, Darwinian evolution, and by the way, I mean macroevolution. I hold to microevolution. I believe there's a lot of changes in the species that take place because of ecological, environmental factors. Species adapt. But Darwin took it much, much farther than that, to macroevolution, that we are descended from primates, and that life is ultimately, human beings are ultimately the result of this random, impersonal force called natural selection. And then finally, nihilism. And the main person here is Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900. He wrote this book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, in which he elevates what he calls the Übermensch, the Superman. And his basic thesis is the strong who can will their way to power will dominate human history. And his ideas, as well as that of Darwin, are prescient, they preview what in the 20th century will become social Darwinism and eugenics, that ultimately might makes right, the survival of the fittest. That's what matters. And so power ultimately will dominate. There's nothing you can do about it. And eugenics then means that because we want the powerful to dominate, we want to be a more powerful human race, then we need to manipulate the gene pool and forced sterilization and all of that, which was very, very popular ideology from, say, 1910 to 1940. Eugenics died, basically, with the Nazis, because the Nazis were great advocates of social Darwinism and eugenics, and they wanted to build up the Aryan race and destroy everything else, all of these marginalized people, people with handicaps, people with mental deficiencies. We need to eliminate them in the gene pool. That is eugenics. And the underpinning of that is social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest. So these are still four very, very powerful currents in human history today, and helped to change the Western world, beginning with Europe and coming to America, the Western world from really a traditional Christian cultural worldview to a very secular humanistic worldview, which continues to predominate today. So, powerful currents directly challenging a theistic worldview. Finally, at the bottom of your handout, it entered into these currents began to be so popular that they began to enter into the religious world as well. And so, major seminary professors and presidents, and of even Christian institutions, began to toy with ideas, at least to a certain extent, from these four currents. And there was a flowering of what is called higher criticism of the Bible. And I've given you, this higher criticism of the Bible entered into all of the mainline denominational seminaries in the late 1800s and especially up to about 1920s, 1930s, where the seminaries of major mainline denominations, and by that I mean the Church of Christ, the United Church of Christ, the United Methodist, the United Presbyterian Church, the Northern Baptist, not so much the Southern Baptist. The Southern Baptists resisted, and they became a segregationist denomination in 1845 so that their members could continue to have slaves. So, not a very fortuitous beginning for the Southern Baptists. I was a member of Southern Baptist Church for a number of years in Columbia. They have refuted that, of course, and apologized and repented of that in recent years, but that was the formation. But many of these mainline denominational seminaries imbibed higher criticism. And let me just read what is my own sort of simple definition of higher criticism. Let me read this, if you'll look at your handout. The Bible is an account of man's existential quest for meaning and purpose. The Old Testament is comprised of creation myths, legendary and semi-factual stories of ancient heroes combined with practical wisdom and prophetic fervor. The New Testament is a record of an inspired teacher, Jesus, whose teachings are elevated and uplifting, especially the Sermon on the Mount. But it is Paul and John that transforms Jesus into the divine Son of God and constructs the main lines of Christian theology. So you can see that they take macroevolution and they apply it to the New Testament. Jesus is a simple Palestinian prophet who had some good ethical ideas. Paul then transforms him in a macroevolutionary way into the Son of God. And then John takes it even further and transforms the Son of God into the second person of the Trinity, the eternal preexistent Son. So there's a macroevolutionary development from one stage to another. That is higher criticism, and it's become very, very popular in most of the mainline denominational seminaries. Let me just give you some names. Friedrich Schleiermacher is one of the pioneers of this, Ferdinand Christian Bauer, and especially Rudolf Bultmann. I've read a lot of Bultmann over the years. Let me say this, though, too. What's been really wonderful in the last, oh, 50 to 75 years is there have risen up, by God's grace, a number of very gifted evangelical Bible-believing theologians. Not just pastors or preachers, but theologians who have studied at the finest universities in the world, Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard. I had several professors in seminary that had PhDs from Harvard, at the finest university in the world, and have become very, very fine advocates defending the historical reliability of the scriptures. I'll just give you a few names. If you want to write them down, you can look up their books. William Ramsay at Aberdeen University, a pioneering archaeologist in Asia Minor. Before William Ramsay, critical scholars, these higher critical scholars said Luke is a great theologian but a terrible historian. He doesn't know what he's doing. After Ramsay, even in the liberal seminaries, Luke knows what he's doing because William Ramsay demonstrated in his works that Luke was very, very careful in the terms he uses. And the Bible has been vindicated by archaeology over and over. William Ramsay. Another young man, Colin Hemer, Hemer, built on the work of William Ramsay and has written some wonderful articles and a book on the book of Acts, demonstrating the historical plausibility and reliability of the gospel. And then, probably the finest textual critic of the early manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, a man named Bruce Metzger. who was a professor of New Testament at Princeton Seminary for many, many years, has written a lot defending the historical reliability and truthfulness of the New Testament, a Bible-believing man. So it's no longer just a bunch of preachers and lay people that are defending the scriptures. It is now many very, very fine, widely recognized scholars who have made a great case for the historical reliability of the scripture. We owe a lot to them. And then there have been some very fine historians who have also done some great work. Mark Knoll, who I've referred to earlier, George Marsden, both of them taught at Notre Dame, and then Nathan Hatch. Nathan Hatch grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. His father was a colleague of mine in the seminary at the Bible College and Seminary in Columbia. He grew up in that family. He went on to become a very fine leading historian of early American Christianity and then became the president of Wake Forest University for many years, a Bible-believing man. So there are fine evangelicals now in many of these places and have made a very strong case that this higher criticism is more of a philosophy than it is something that is really something that is grounded in solid evidence. It's really more of just a viewpoint that is spawned by some of these other currents that we've just looked at. Finally, I want to say this. Hebrews 13:7 says, "When you consider those whom you are to follow and listen to, your leaders." Hebrews 13:7 says, "Consider the outcome of their way of life. Look and see what their teaching has done for them personally. What are they like? What is their legacy? What is their family like? What is their character like? Consider their outcome when you consider leaders." Immanuel Kant, think about Immanuel Kant. Well, he wasn't a bad man. He was just an ivory tower man who toyed with various ideas. His friend said you could set the clock by the exact moment that he would leave his home in the morning and walk to his office, and you could set your clock by the time he would leave his office in the afternoon and return to his home. Never married, never had a family. 60 years at the University of Königsberg, he was an ivory tower theologian toying with ideas. Now, is that the type of person that you want to necessarily follow? I don't think so. Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin was a hardworking man. He collected a lot of specimens of the invertebrates and studied them. He came to his own conclusions. He began wanting to study theology early. As a church going, coming up in a, growing up in a church-going family, his friends described him at the end of his life as lonely and troubled. His wife, he had a happy marriage to his wife, Emma. Emma Wedgwood, you heard of Wedgwood Pottery? She's from a wealthy family. And when she was going to her Unitarian church on Sunday morning, his friends, Charles Darwin's friends, said that he would kind of plod along the streets of Cambridge and down Kent, troubled, depressed, troubled, and wrestling. He never became an atheist. He went back and forth, back and forth. There is a creator, there's not. There is a creator, there's not. He ended up concluding there's not, and he had really no joy or purpose in his life. Do you want to follow someone like that? Well, it gets worse. Karl Marx, the great defender of the working class, never worked a day in his life. He spent decades holed up in the British Library, poring over dusty manuscripts with economic theories. His poor, long-suffering wife and his children lived in penury, and he was dependent on the support of Frederick Engels, his partner in the Marxist ideology that he proposed. And Engels supported Marx's family while he just kind of studied his theories. He was bitter. He was angry at the world, and he was alienated, and his family ended up in penury. And the worst of all, Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche was the son of a Lutheran pastor. He walked away and became an agnostic. And later in life, he descended into delusional conspiracy theories. He finally went stark mad and ended his life in a sanitarium, contemplating suicide. Consider the outcome. Consider the outcome of the kind of people that you want to follow. So I think that's a good warning for us, that when we are toying with the ideas of someone who comes forward with various ideas or worldviews or thoughts, we listen, but we keep our critical lenses on, and we remember to study the outcome of those whom we're listening to, so that we have discernment and wisdom. Now, I'm going to get back to my trivia question. I have 15 minutes left. Yes, but I'm disciplined today. Disciplined. 15 minutes left. How many of the 45 presidents of the United States, 45 men who have been president, have been baptized members of a Christian denomination? I want to guess. Anybody?
Four.
Four? You better up that a little bit.
No. I was gonna be crazy and guess all of them.
That's what Melissa said too, all of them. You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because of the country that we're in.
I'm sure.
44.
Well, 44.
44, not four. 44. Okay.
Well, I was close.
You got one four right
If you
anyway.
just round it up.
The only president that we have had who has not been a member of a Christian denomination is my favorite person in American history. This man. This man. You all know that. He doesn't have his top hat on, but this man, Abraham Lincoln. I love Abraham Lincoln. In world history, the most written about person in all of world history is Jesus of Nazareth, and he clears the field by a long way. Books, monologues, dissertations, articles. Number two in world history is a close tie, and you read historians, they'll say, "Is this guy? No, it's this guy." You want to guess who they are?
Alexander the Great.
Martin Luther, Napoleon Bonaparte. Who did you say?
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great. Well, a lot have been written about him as well. But in American history, this man clears the field by a long shot. More books written about Abraham Lincoln than anyone else. So I want to talk a little bit about Abraham Lincoln. There's a wonderful book about Abraham Lincoln called Lincoln's Battle with God. It's an interesting, very interesting analysis of his struggles. So now you say, "Why are you going to talk about Abraham Lincoln?" Because I want to. And I'm your teacher this morning. So for 15 minutes. Abraham Lincoln, because he had such an important impact on this country, ended slavery, navigated the Civil War. He was born in 1809, in a log cabin in rural Kentucky, to a man named Thomas Lincoln. His father was a hard, what they called a hard shell Baptist. He was at church every time the door was open. But they called him the hard shell or very strict Baptist of the day in rural Kentucky. He was very harsh, dogmatic. He liberally applied corporal discipline to young Abraham, their oldest son, whenever he would not work the farm like he wanted him to. His mother, Sarah, softened the home life, and Abraham was a sensitive boy, intellectual boy. And she died when he was 9 years old. So he was now left with his sister and his father was hard on him. When he became a teenager, he really walked away from any kind of Christian teaching. He was so angry at his father, bitter at his father's treatment. And they had a lifelong struggle. Although he writes a very tender letter to his stepsister when his father dies. They did reconcile. He rejected the Christian faith early on for several reasons. Number one, his father was harsh and he identified Christianity with the strict, disciplinary, harsh, and he saw God that way. We oftentimes see God the way we have our earthly fathers. We oftentimes, if we have a hard, difficult father, it's difficult to know God as our father. And the same is true if you have a good father. He was also dragged off to these camp meetings. Remember the camp meetings in the Second Great Awakening? And they were very, oftentimes very emotional, strange, fire and brimstone preaching with all sorts of emotional outbreaks. And he heard and saw a lot of things that repelled him. He was not a kind of young boy that could be influenced that way. He was a very rational thinker. He loved to read. He was self-taught. He was an autodidact. He read the Bible. He read Pilgrim's Progress. He read Shakespeare very early in life and memorized large sections of it. His father would beat him when he found him under a tree reading. And he finally said, "I just can't get it out of the boy. He just keeps going back to those books." He also took several trips down to New Orleans and saw the cruelty of slavery. Oftentimes, the cruelty of Christian slave owners. And he was repelled by the hypocrisy of it. This cannot be true. So he walked away. He finally left home at the age of 22, had enough of the farm, and he moved to New Salem, Illinois, sort of a frontier town there in northwest Illinois. And from the age of 22 to 28, he lived there. He was first a clerk in a store, and then he did surveying work, and then he became a state senator, Illinois state senator. He was very eloquent and hardworking and ambitious, and he became known as the town infidel. I would not repeat some of the things that he said and did during those years. They were blasphemous. He prided himself on being one who could refute the Christian faith, refute the deity of Jesus, refute the truth of the Bible. And all of his friends said he would joyfully engage in conversation where he could refute these foolish Christians that are going off to church. Finally, in 1837, he moved to the capital, Springfield, Illinois, where he would live the next 24 years until he was elected president. He married Mary Todd, a nominal Episcopalian, at the age of 33 in 1842, and they had four sons. During these years, things began to change for him. Number one, his son Eddie died at the age of 3 of tuberculosis. Number two, Mary, though she had a lot of emotional problems, had a spiritual longing, and she did want to go to church from time to time. And they met Dr. James Smith, who was the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church, and he began to go with her to church and sit and listen, initially just to critique and criticize, but then he was sort of beginning to engage. This was the first time that he met Christians who kind of had thought through and were serious about Bible reading and Bible study, not just emotional fire and brimstone. That didn't appeal to him. Dr. Smith had written a book called In Defense of the Christian Faith that he got a copy of and he took home and he read it. It was a very well-written book by an educated doctor, Dr. James Smith of the First Presbyterian Church. And his second son, Eddie, died in 1850, as I just mentioned. They had two more sons. And his attitude began to change. He began to say, "Well, maybe I was too harsh. Maybe I overreacted." And he began to consider Christianity, though he made no profession. Remember, never baptized, never joined a church till the day he died. November 6, 1860, he is elected President of the United States. April 1861, Fort Sumter. A month after he's inaugurated, the Civil War. Halfway through his term as president, his beloved son Willie, at the age of 11, dies of typhoid fever. It crushes him, and Mary becomes unhinged. It's her second son to die. During this time, when he became president, he decided he and Mary were going to go to church in Washington. Everyone told him, you need to go to the First Presbyterian Church. That's where all the shakers and movers are. You can network and you can build your political base. That's where a lot of the earlier presidents had gone. He said, no, I get politics all week. When I go to church, I want to hear gospel. So he went. The pastor there was a wonderful preacher, a man named Dr. Phineas Gurley. Huh?
What church?
New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, instead of the First Presbyterian. He went to a medium-sized church, pastored by Dr. Phineas Gurley. When Willie died, he and Mary were just distraught, but they asked Gurley to preach the sermon. A large group gathered in the East Room of the White House. The East Room's now been demolished. Have you seen that? In the East Room of the White House, and he preached a sermon taken from Mark 7:37, where it was said of Jesus, he doeth all things well. King James, he doeth all things well. And here is how he closed his sermon. 30-minute sermon, these were the final words. Only let us bow in his presence with a humble and teachable spirit. Let us be still and know that he is God. Let us acknowledge his hand and hear his voice, and inquire after his will, and seek his Holy Spirit as our counselor and guide. And all, in the end, all will be well. In his light shall we see light. By his grace our sorrows will be sanctified. They will be made a blessing to our souls. And by, we shall have occasion to say with blended gratitude and rejoicing, it is good for us that we have been afflicted. Courageous sermon by Phineas Gurley on the death of Willie. Lincoln and Mary asked for a manuscript of the sermon. They went home and Lincoln read it over and over and over again. During these years in the White House, he attended regularly. He and Mary rented a pew. That's what they used to do, rented a pew up in the front left-hand corner of the church. And he even attended Thursday night prayer meetings. But because it drew attention to himself when he came, he sat in the pastor's office and listened and participated in those prayers. Dr. Gurley has written memoirs about his relationship with Abraham Lincoln, who oftentimes called him to the White House to have long conversations about life and death. Remember, he's navigating a terrible civil war with long lists of casualties coming in from Shiloh and Antietam and Cold Harbor, terrible carnage. And he's having to navigate that. And Gurley says in his memoirs, he says, I am confident that Abraham Lincoln came to know the Savior in a personal way. And he implies and is hoping that on Good Friday of 1865, Easter Sunday of 1865, it's good to have a wife that keeps me straight. She's saved me 1,000 times in the past. The Lord looked down on me and said, that boy needs help, and he did. So anyway, where was I? He said on the Easter Sunday that he was going to come forward and confess faith and put himself forward for membership, but he was assassinated on Good Friday. His second inaugural address. Now I'm going to close with this. Second inaugural address. Just read a portion of it. And this is a marvelous book from the Library of Congress. All of his original writings and letters and speeches, the Gettysburg Address and so forth, written in his own hand on the left, a facsimile. And then it's a wonderful book. You can purchase it. You want to read it, Lincoln. I've read through it a number of times. Great, great volume. No inaugural has ever wrestled with the purpose of God in history based on Scripture, as Abraham Lincoln did in that second inaugural. It is a speech that is worth pondering and reading over and over again. So I'm going to close with this. Both, remember now, this is given on, the second inaugural is given on March the 4th, 1865. Lee surrenders to Grant on April the 9th, and he's assassinated on April the 14th, so 5 weeks later, after this inaugural address. The war's not over yet, but it's almost over. Both the North and South read the same Bible and pray to the same God. Each one invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be not judged. Matthew 7:1. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses. For it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. Matthew 18:7. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came. Shall we discern, therefore, any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as it was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Psalm 19:9. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, for his widow and for his orphan, and to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Wrestling with divine providence and the purposes of a terrible war. A president determined to bind the nation together, not to tear the nation apart. Let that be something we remember. A good president, a good leader brings people together, does not divide people. We are the United States of America.